from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Stephanie Land struggled to make ends meet while working as a maid for less than $9 an hour. In her new memoir, she writes about being a nameless ghost to the clients whose homes she cleaned, of being a survivor of domestic violence and a single mother on public assistance. Stephanie Land's story helps shed light on the grim reality faced by many of America's working poor. She joins us after this news. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When Stephanie Land was 28 years old, an unplanned pregnancy with a man she'd been dating for a few months cut short her dreams of going to college and becoming a writer. The man's violent episodes led her to leave with her baby daughter and ultimately to a homeless shelter. She ended up cleaning houses to try and make ends meet, and her memoir about her experiences is called Maid, that's M-A-I-D, Hard Work, Low Pay, and A Mother's Will to Survive. Stephanie Land, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here, and congratulations on your book, which is no small feat for anyone, but as Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of Nickel and Dime, notes in your foreword, despair, exhaustion, stigma, a work injury, any of those things can beset especially the working poor and could have stopped this book from ever being written.
Yeah, it's not very affordable to write. So a lot of times the poor just they don't have the energy or the resources or even the ability to sit down and write.
So it's a rare voice told in this way, and you tell a lot. You've been through a lot, an unplanned pregnancy. You've experienced domestic violence, homelessness, health problems, the struggle to get public assistance. And any one of those topics could have been the focus of your book, but you decided to center it on your time as a maid. Why?
Well, the book came out of an essay that had gone viral through Vox, and they titled it something like, I cleaned houses for 2 years and what I saw made me never want to be rich, you know, like this clickbaity title. But that piece went so wildly viral, and it resulted in the book deal. And going into writing the book, I thought that would be the interesting part, was like the voyeurism of like, what's it like to be in people's houses and clean their houses? But my editor really encouraged me to bring the social justice aspect out of it. And before in pitching the book and talking to publishers, I kind of wanted that to be like the hidden gut punch, like Upton Sinclair, you know, hitting us all in the stomachs when he was trying to write about the meatpacking industry. But that was the part of the book that was really encouraged by my publisher and my editor, and ultimately what people are really connected to and interested in. When to me, writing it, that was like writing about what I had for breakfast, because it was so ingrained in my daily life.
And well, let's start with the part that you thought would get everybody's attention, which is what it's like to be a maid. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions or lack of understanding around what that role is and what it requires?
Well, it's so invisible. And I felt really degraded because of that. I felt like my job didn't matter. I felt like me as a person didn't matter, because if I had to call in sick or call in because my daughter was sick, then I risked losing that client because they wanted someone who would get there at the time that they said that they were going to. And I felt like I wasn't allowed to be a human being.
And on the reverse side, they could cancel on you at any moment when you desperately needed the money for the job.
Yeah, exactly. Just not really knowing how much I severely needed, you know, the $20 or $40, because that would mean paying my electric bill or paying rent that month.
And you worked for a long time for $8.55 an hour.
Yeah, it started off as that. And then I think by the time I quit, it was up to $9.25 an hour.
And how long were you doing this?
A couple of years.
You have a passage in your chapter called The Chef's House, which is one of the homes that you clean, which I think describes some of that feeling. Would you mind reading it for us?
Sure. All right. They worked to pay Classic Clean.
Do you want to set this up at all?
Oh, sure.
I don't know if there's anything you want before you get started. Sorry.
Yeah. So I named every house. Not every house, but the houses that I didn't really get to know the people who lived in them. I just started referring it in my mind, never to my employers.
Because they typically weren't home, or in a lot of cases they wouldn't be home when you arrived.
And so this was the chef's house, and it's one of the original clients that the cleaning company had. And it was he had this huge stove that he joked about being more expensive than my car. And, you know, I met him only one time, but he was very proud of his kitchen and the parties that he had. And their whole house was kind of like set up like a French bistro. And but it was an incredibly difficult house to clean. And I only had 3 hours, and there was a lot of mopping involved. And
for the entire home.
Yeah, yeah. And it had kind of two wings, and then every once in a while I had to clean like a whole other bunker house, garage, converted thing. And it was really hard work. And so in this scene, I'm just kind of talking about how much I had wanted a house like that originally, and how I'd imagined that to be a happy life, but then realizing how much of my role in their life is keeping up this sort of illusion of grandeur that they had. So I'll start reading. They worked to pay Classic Clean, who paid me just above minimum wage, to keep it all spotless, in place, acceptable. While they paid for my work like some magical cleaning fairy, I was anything but that, shuffling through their house like a ghost. My face had an ashen hue from a lack of sun, dark circles under my eyes from a lack of sleep. Usually my hair was unwashed, pulled back into a ponytail or under a kerchief or hat. I wore pairs of Carhartt cargo pants until the holes in the knees were unsightly enough that my boss told me to replace them. My job afforded me little money to spend on clothes, even for work. I worked through illnesses and brought my daughter to daycare when she should have been at home with me. My job offered no sick pay, no vacation days, no foreseeable increase in wage, yet through it all, still I begged to work more. Wages lost from missed work hours could rarely be made up, and if I missed too many, I risked being fired. My car's reliability was vital, since a broken hose, a faulty thermostat, or even a flat tire could throw us off, knock us backward, send us teetering, falling back toward homelessness. We lived and we survived in that careful imbalance. This was my unwitnessed existence, as I polished another's to make theirs appear perfect. The chef's house had two wings, the guest bedroom and an office on one end, and the master bathroom with a hallway that led to a converted garage where their dogs, two white Westminster terriers, always left puddles of pee. They went with either Mr. Lund or his wife to work on the days that I cleaned. I hadn't noticed one had also started pooping by the dining room table, and I'd accidentally walked through it. I groaned. Beige carpet, light beige, almost white. There was no way I'd be able to rub out poop stains.
And that's Stephanie Land reading from her memoir, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. It talks about her backbreaking work of cleaning homes on minimum wage to make ends meet for her and her daughter. And by backbreaking, that's not just a figure of speech. I mean, you were in a lot of physical pain. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with scoliosis when I was a child, I think when I was still in elementary school. And it never really mattered or made too big of a difference in my life until my late 20s. And it kind of did a whole new curve. And I lost feeling down my right arm, couldn't hold a pen anymore. But then when I started working as a house cleaner, that meant not being able to hold a scrub brush or a sponge. And so a lot of the times when I was cleaning, I had to kind of make a fist and scrub that way, like with the sponge in between my fist and the surface. But I injured myself pretty frequently. Like if I lifted something heavy or unexpectedly heavy most of the time, my back would just kind of go out. Or I would get so tired from a lot of the times it was the position of having to mop, like just being in that position was something my back really didn't like. And a lot of mornings I would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning in so much pain that I couldn't go back to sleep. And that was a pretty normal existence for me.
And it was also interesting. I was struck by a moment when you have one of the people who is actually pretty kind to you. One of the homeowners is pretty kind to you and offers you a pair of Mariners tickets, I think, if this was, because this was all in Washington State where, mm-hmm. where you lived. And it was like front row seats, and it was a dream to go there, and didn't realize that there was no way that you could pay for the gas and the parking to even go to the baseball game. So while this gesture was very nice, it really showed a complete lack of understanding of what your true situation was.
Yeah. I ended up selling those tickets, I think, for $60. And so there was a good happy ending with that. But the people I sold it to, if it was a father and he was taking his son to his first baseball game for his birthday, and his son was the same age as my daughter. And so bittersweet money made on those tickets, I guess.
Yeah. And what is something that you'd like people who employ house cleaners to know or think about?
Well, I've been seeing a lot of comments from people on Twitter and then through my website, and they've said, like, I learned the name of the woman who cleans my office building and asked her about her family and her children. And like, I don't think that people really recognize how many people are making our lives easier on a daily basis. I mean, anywhere from like the street cleaners to the garbage men to, you know, the bus boys. But all of these people are struggling to survive, to feed their families, and they deserve to be treated like human beings.
We're talking with Stephanie Land. She's a freelance journalist and the author of Maid, Hard Work, Low Pay, and A Mother's Will to Survive. She was a writing fellow through both the Center for Community Change and Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Stepping back a little bit, so how did you get into this situation? So you grew up in a relatively middle or lower middle class home. Would that be the correct description?
Yeah, I never thought... I mean, my parents were very tight with money, and there wasn't a lot of money for me to do any extracurricular activities or, you know, anything that I wanted to do after school. I was always reminded, like, well, we don't really have money for that. But, you know, I grew up in what you would think of as the suburbs of Alaska. I don't know if people really associate suburbs with Alaska, but, you know, I had a pretty normal life. My mom... was the first one in our family to get a college degree, and she fought really hard to not put her children through the life that she had grown up in, which was very poor.
And then you have dreams of becoming a writer. You meet a boy named Jamie. 4 months later, you find out that you're pregnant, and you were both going to kind of go your separate ways, right? You wanted to try to pursue college and a writing degree. And he really is unhappy about the fact that you are pregnant and your decision to have this baby. And he becomes increasingly violent with you. What ultimately led you to, in some ways, did he push you out, even though you were growing increasingly fearful? Can you talk about sort of that conundrum where you were unsafe, but yet didn't feel like you could leave?
Yeah, I think that is the experience of a lot of women experiencing domestic violence. I didn't have money. And so when I found out I was pregnant, we were actually living together in this tiny little like camper trailer to save money. And he kicked me out of that living situation. And so I did a lot of house cleaning gigs and stayed with friends, I think, a couple of times. And eventually... through a friend, found this little cottage to move into, and that's where Mia was born. And then he kind of came back around the time of her birth, and I had money saved up at that point, like I think $3,000. And transferred it into his bank account because I thought, like, oh, okay, so we're going to be good now. Like, he's coming around and stepped up to the plate. He had a full-time job. So moved in with him. And within a couple of months, it was all, a lot of temper tantrums on his part. And so I asked him if I could start working. And he said that he didn't want to spend his time off babysitting his child. And then I found out that he had spent all of my savings. And so by the time we got in an argument that led me to leave, I had absolutely no money. And I was extremely depressed at that point. And, you know, when you have someone telling you you're crazy and all of the other things that he liked to call me on a daily basis, it really tears you down. And so I went into single motherhood thinking that I was just completely worthless and ugly and, you know, not deserving of anything. And so I had to not only like build up my situation in order to take care of my kid, I had to build up my self-confidence as well.
Yes. And in terms of being torn down, what was also tearing you down, as you write about so vividly in your book, is the stigma against the poor and the efforts to try to prove you're poor so that you can get public assistance as well. I was struck by a moment when you were relaying to a friend or someone you thought was a friend about just some of the different types of public assistance you were on. And could you describe her reaction?
Yeah. So this was a good friend of mine. We'd been friends for about 10 years. And I was telling her, I called her from the homeless shelter, actually, and was kind of like filling her in on what was going on. And told her, I said, but I qualified for food stamps and I'm going to try and get on this housing assistance program. And I got some WIC checks and I was just kind of listing all of these resources that I had been looking very hard for and like finally received. And so I was saying it in a way that like, I'm so relieved these people and these organizations are helping me. And her reaction was, oh, well, you're welcome. And I said, excuse me? And she said, well, my tax money is paying for that. So you're welcome. Like she had personally contributed to all of that. And we're still in contact and I had to tell her, I'm like, so you're in the book. And she said, yeah, I figured I would be. And so she knows now like how horrible that was to say. Mm. But there were a lot of moments like that of trying to tell people like I'm doing okay because I have food stamps and them saying like, oh, well, you're like I'm accepting a handout. Like that's a term used so much. Like it's some kind of fault of mine that I'm accepting this help. That
yes.
Is...
And your father himself was not, it was definitely not of means. And even at one point there was an episode you described where he was somewhat violent. And then there, your mother is out of the picture. She's divorced him and escaped to Europe and really out of the picture for you. So you really had no net at all. And your friend's reaction is sort of representative of a broader reaction that you're getting. And you write about how hard it was to access those benefits that you write at one point or you say at one point that it's expensive. So it was so expensive to be poor. Can you just talk about the challenge of trying to prove that you needed the benefit and then holding on to it once you got it?
Yeah. A lot of the jobs that I found were through friends and were under the table, even though like I counted them towards taxes at the end of the year. But I didn't have a paycheck or anything like that. So proving that you're not only working in that situation is, you know, taking physical copies of checks that you receive, having letters from clients saying like that I was working in their home at those times, because there are so many work requirements wrapped up in qualifying for Medicaid and SNAP and utility assistance and especially child care. And the way that child care grants work is you have to have a job first and prove that you're working in order to get child care, which is completely backwards. Like, how are you supposed to be working when you need child care for your kid? And it's incredibly hard to not only prove that you're working, but to prove that you don't have any hidden resources or bank accounts or property. They're very suspicious of people taking advantage to the point that I don't even know how you could, really, because you're constantly having to prove all of these things.
Could I ask you, before we go into the break, to just read one more passage for me? And this is a moment when you are transitioning from the homeless shelter into transitional housing.
Yeah.
And I think it, well, just read it and then we can talk about it.
So this was the day that I moved out of the homeless shelter. And my mom and her husband were helping me. So, half the residents in our new apartment building, the Northwest Passage Transitional Housing Program, were like me, moving out of homeless shelters, but the other half were people who had just gotten out of jail. It was supposed to be a step up from the shelter, but I already missed the seclusion of the cabin. Here in this building, my reality felt exposed for all to see, even me. We walked into the narrow entryway. The front door sat opposite the bathroom. Right away, I noticed the tub, where Mia and I could take a bath together. We hadn't had the luxury of a tub in a long time. Our two bedrooms were on my right. Each had a window that faced the road. In the tiny kitchen, the refrigerator door grazed the cupboards on the opposite side. I walked across the large white tiles, which resembled the floor at the shelter, and opened the door to a small outdoor deck. It was wide enough where I could sit with my legs stretched out. Julie, my caseworker, had briefly shown me the place in a walkthrough 2 weeks earlier. The last family who lived in the apartment had stayed for 24 months, the maximum amount of time possible. "You're lucky this one opened up," she said, "especially since your days were up at the shelter." When I first met with Julie, I sat across from her, stammering in my attempts to answer questions about what my plans were, how I planned to provide shelter for my child, what my path to financial stability looked like, what jobs I could do. Julie seemed to understand my bewilderment, offering some suggestions on how to proceed. Moving into low-income housing seemed to be my only option. The trouble was finding an empty slot. There were advocates at the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Services Center who kept a protected shelter available for victims who had nowhere to turn. But I had gotten lucky when the housing authority offered me my own space and path to stability. Julie and I went over a 4-page list of terse rules during that first meeting, rules I had to agree to in order to stay at their shelter. Guest understands this is not an emergency shelter. Or this is an emergency shelter. This is not your home. Random urinalysis may be requested at any time. Visitors are not allowed at the shelter. No exceptions.
That's Stephanie Land reading from her memoir, Made. What are your questions for Stephanie Land? Call us at 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at forum@kqed.org. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Stephanie Land, whose memoir, Made, M-A-I-D, chronicles her struggles with homelessness and the backbreaking work of cleaning homes on minimum wage to make ends meet for her and her daughter. What are your questions for Stephanie Land? Have you worked as a maid or housekeeper? What was the hardest part about it for you? Or do you employ a maid or housekeeper? And is Land's story giving you new insights or making you reconsider how you treat house cleaners? Did you have to care for a family yourself on minimum wage? How did you make ends meet? You can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook or Twitter. And Stephanie Land, I had asked you to read that passage because two things struck me about it that you've highlighted. One is that your caseworker called you lucky to get this space. And that was a word that you found yourself reacting to.
Yeah, I mean, just given the whole entirety of the situation, I wasn't very lucky at all. But in a sense, I was. Like, there was an available spot for me to move into. And without that, I don't know what would have happened. But I did not feel like luck had been shown on me by any means.
And then those rules that you had to submit to a urinalysis, you couldn't have visitors and so on. You described being there feeling more like probation.
Yeah, I was constantly checking in. I was, I had to report all of the income. I had to report how that income went out. I had to, I had to have people in my home making sure that I kept the place clean. And it was really weird. I mean, it felt like they assumed that I was this sort of person that I didn't feel that I was, but yet I had to do all of this stuff in order to keep my housing.
Well, we have calls and questions coming in. April writes, whenever I see someone cleaning a public restroom, I say thank you for your work. We all appreciate it. We're sometimes so busy that we don't say thank you, but we really appreciate what you do. Thank you. The smiles I receive are beautiful. And let me go to Janine in Pacifica. Hi, Janine.
Hi. Thank you so much for this topic. I really appreciate it. My parents were janitors, and sometimes people act like I almost should be ashamed of what they did to totally support my siblings and I. And I was just wondering what you would recommend to help people understand that those people should be respected and treated that way, and how you do that, like kind of change your mindset around people who do that kind of work.
Janine, thanks.
Well, I think it just goes down to a human level. I mean, and to really imagine yourself getting on your knees and scrubbing behind a stranger's toilet and then having to do that four or five times more a day. And just if you think about just looking people in the eye, like the other person had said, and just like looking at them and saying thank you and just acknowledging like, I can see that you're in this position, not necessarily because you have to be not necessarily because you want to be, but because you have to be. But I still appreciate the work that you're doing, because essentially it's helping my life be better.
Well, Maria says, I appreciate Stephanie. However, she's getting all the attention because she's white. No matter how bad she had it, there are millions of immigrants that have it worse. People that have to take their kids to work and work 365 days a year making $4 or $5 an hour. What's your reaction to Maria's point, Stephanie?
I mean, that is the limiting part of memoir. I can only write my story. But the more I talk to people, the more I try to just be very plain about that fact, is that my book is very privileged and people are paying attention to it, I think, because I am on the other side and I have an education and, you know, they are calling me a success story of the government assistance system.
Who's that, they?
A lot of comments
I see.
A lot of the reaction.
I didn't know if actually public entities were trying to hold up your story and saying, see how we help this person and how our programs work.
But I know that legislators kind of talk that way. Like when they see someone come out of it and are successful, they say, see, all of our systems are working because it brought this person to this place. But I recognize my privilege very much. It is a very privileged story. I am a white person, but I am hoping that because people are listening to my story, that they'll start listening to the more adverse stories and the people who have been living this life for generations that normally we wouldn't even pay attention to or listen to anything that they're saying, because we kind of want to pretend like they're not there.
What's your reaction to someone who does want to hold up our current system as one that proves that your story proves that it is an effective and appropriate system? Because you don't necessarily go after the system so much as you just describe your own experiences using it, which then ultimately I would say would be an indictment on the way that it operates. But
yeah, I mean, I'm still drastically in debt from student loans. You know, I'm still driving an older car. I don't own my own home. I don't even know when I'm going to be able to do any of that. And I got a book deal, you know, that's not like a normal thing for, and like, I can't even count on one hand the people that I know personally who that's happened to. And if that hadn't have happened, I would still be struggling. I'd still be in low-income housing. I'd probably be in and out of needing food stamps, because I was working as a freelancer, and that's not always a dependable job. So,
how old is your daughter now, and have you read her the book? Like, is she more aware of what the circumstances have been?
She's slowly reading it. I got a text from her last night where she read a part about me having nightmares about her going to the ER because I was cleaning a house where I didn't have cell phone reception. And that was terrifying to me because I was the only person that anyone could call. And if I didn't have cell phone reception, if anything happened to her, then I wouldn't know about it. And she texted me. She said, "You were worried that I was going to go to the ER?" And it's like, yeah. But she's 11 and a half now. She's slowly working her way through the book. And I'm kind of wondering how her reaction will change the older she gets.
Well, let's hear next from Katie in San Anselmo. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I really appreciate hearing about your situation. I had something similar. I have two young kids, and my husband, their dad, left when the youngest was an infant. And being able to get support was so difficult. You know, I went through all the hoops and went to all the appointments, and I went and got a job and then went to go ask for childcare. And they said, "You make too much now. You're not going to be able to get it." And so here I was with this job where I didn't make enough to pay for childcare, but I made too much to get childcare support. And so it just made things difficult. And I remember the WIC checks, it was so hard to go and redeem those because I would go to the store and the cashiers wouldn't know how to do it. And they would, you know, sigh and, "Oh God, what do I have to do?" And they would make this big production of it. And it would take so long that the people behind me were rolling their eyes. And it was so embarrassing. And I ended up, you know, figuring out that if you went to the less affluent part of town and went to the store there, they knew how to do it. And there just was a shocking amount of shame and the way you're treated and the difficulty it is to get help.
Well, Katie, thanks for sharing your story. One of the things that, as we mentioned at the very beginning, was how it can become incredibly overwhelming. And I'm wondering, when did it become really overwhelming to you? When did you reach the point where you thought, "I can't do this"? Whether it be cleaning, when you were cleaning a home, or just, you know.
There is a point in the book that I realized that it's not paying me enough to do this job.
And so, cleaning homes.
Cleaning homes, yeah. Or just working for the cleaning company. I had started gathering my own clients underneath me and was able to charge them a lot more and got a lot of those jobs through word of mouth. And so I decided to take out the full amount of student loans to supplement my living expenses and then work part-time as a self-employed cleaner because it was too much for me to work for so little pay.
And how did you get past that point? How did you end up coping and lifting yourself up?
Well, I don't know. I refer to it as ducking down and barreling through. Like I just felt like I just had to get through it, and I had to kind of gather all of my strength just to make it through a day. I did go through a process every morning of waking up and thinking to myself, like, I do not want to do anything that I have to do today, but I had to. And a lot of the times that was leaving my daughter at daycare, even though she was crying and sick and should have been at home, and going to this job where I had to do all of this like gross, disgusting work and come home and spend a couple of hours with her if I was lucky, and then get up the next morning and do it all over again.
Where did your desire to be a writer come from? And how were you able to keep that dream alive, essentially?
Well, it started when I was pretty young, like Mia's age, or the age Mia is now. I had a fourth grade teacher who forced us to keep journals, and I just kept doing that. And I read everything that I could get my hands on. And by the time I was in my mid-20s, I think I recognized that being a writer was just part of my ingrained identity. And so I very much wanted to do that or figure out how to do that professionally, because I had no idea. And so it became a driving force just in that part of me speaking up every once in a while, saying like, no, this is what you're supposed to be doing. And so it was kind of annoying, but also motivating.
Because as you said earlier, one of the biggest issues was just also believing in yourself, or your sense of self-worth was so damaged through the relationship that you'd had with Mia's father, and just moving through all that and trying to believe that you were worthy. The other strategy that I was struck by in reading your book was that you talked about being very present-oriented, very short-sighted, meaning you just focused as much as possible on the next day or the next hour, as opposed to dreaming of the future.
Yeah. A lot of that was just my situation, and I didn't know how or when I was going to be able to get out of that, because it felt like every time that I was a little bit ahead, something happened that would knock me backwards. And imagining 5 years from then was like imagining my life still being that way. And that was horrible to imagine. I didn't want to think about 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And so instead of like really trying to plan for that, I just told myself to have enough faith in myself that we would get out of it eventually, even though I didn't always believe that was true.
Stephanie Land's memoir is Made, M-A-I-D, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. She appears tonight at 7 at Copperfields Books in Petaluma tomorrow, and Saturday at 4 p.m. at Booksmith's, The Bindery in San Francisco. She'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 1 on Sunday. This listener writes, I was a single mom who cleaned houses after putting myself through university. I had a bone disease in my hip joint as a child, and though I had limited mobility, it didn't matter because we still had to eat. I didn't have an operating car and had to walk while in so much pain. Cleaning houses was slow and painful. Thankfully, I was able to get food stamps. My daughter is now in her early 30s and fine, but she said those years have given her an unhealthy level of terrible anxiety.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I see that a lot in my daughter. She has no less than 4 calendars surrounding her in her bedroom. And she has been like that since she was 4 or 5 years old. I think because she was shuffled around so much. And I projected a lot of my anxiety over her finishing her meals, because she wouldn't eat leftovers. And so there was that amount of stress that she saw in me, but also, she needs to know what's going to happen at all times. And she is very orderly and very, very in the know of like everything. So, and I believe that that's because of anxiety, and partially because of who she is. But I think the shuffling around affected her.
Well, Jordan writes, please have your guest explain why it's bad to have had her friend say thank you, or you're welcome, when she said she was on public assistance. I've been on food stamps and public assistance, and I do thank my friends and people for that service. I think we should all recognize and acknowledge our social contract more and say thank you. And as taxpayers, feel good about the contributions we make. Making public assistance anonymous only further alienates us from each other.
In my experience, I have never had someone say you're welcome in a sincere way. Like, it was more like a begrudgingly, I am doing this resentfully. I think people feel better about giving food, or, you know, giving toys, or giving very specific things that they know that person will use to a person who they believe deserves it. There were a lot of times that friends would drop off toys at my door, on my doorstep, or offer us a sled to use or help us out in all of these ways. And I was very grateful for that. And I think they were grateful that they were able to help me. But when it came to taxpayers paying towards this system that they felt that so many people were taking advantage of, I never felt like there was a sincere welcome. You're welcome with that.
Well, Susan writes, at the time you became pregnant, which diverted you from other life plans, why did you decide to go through with the pregnancy? Birth control and abortion were available at that time.
Yeah, and I actually was on birth control. There was that part of it.
This was, right, a totally fluke thing, kind of.
It was kind of crazy that it happened. So there were two things. My mom told me when I was a teenager, for some reason, that she almost went through an abortion with me, and she worded it as I sat in the parking lot and just couldn't go through with it. And that really affected me. Like, I'm not, I'm definitely pro-choice, and I don't fault anyone for who has chosen that. But for me, it was personal. Like, what if she had decided to abort me? I wouldn't be here. And that felt really weird. And I was old enough, and I felt like I was responsible enough for it.
Well, let's go next to Joey in Colorado. Hi, Joey.
Oh, hi there. My comment, first of all, is to the author, thank you for all your work. I'm always so grateful to the people that I feel so blessed that can come and help me, you know, here at my home. But I remember living there in the Palo Alto area at a major university on the campus there and hearing these horror stories by these women, Latino women. And they would tell me things like they would clean these homes of Caucasian home. There were Caucasian homeowners. And one time she told me that the homeowner, she ran into her car and didn't pay for those damages, but she kept this Latino house cleaner kept going there to clean her house because she had to, you know. And I just was horrified, and I just thought, my gosh, where is the fairness in any of this, and just where's the empathy that people that hire other people to help them out live their beautiful lives, where is that, you know, where's the compassion, because this is difficult work. At any rate, that's all I want to say. Thanks so much for listening.
Joey, thanks. Did you want to respond to Joey?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were times that I would show up and the person was home and I had to clean the kitchen and I had to get out of there by a certain amount of time. And they were like making this huge mess and on the phone. And when I was kind of edging in on their space, they said to the person on the phone, like, oh, I've got to go. The maid's here. And like I was some huge inconvenience when I was literally cleaning up after them.
Well, Mimi in San Francisco, what's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to thank the author for her book. I haven't read it, and I've just listened to a couple of the interviews. I have a couple of points. It is amazing that you were able to migrate and create a different life for yourself. Our social public policies don't really provide enough money or food stamps to really care for people that aren't doing well. And we have a system that vilifies them, makes them feel bad. I mean, it's amazing to me the culture that we live in, and we have so much money in this country. And I love the fact that you highlight that. And then talking about the discompassionate part of wealthy people whose homes you clean, and sometimes they're, you know, in a bubble or not thinking about things. And it just, you know, it's nice to have that open conversation so people know how they should be as human beings. And I'm going to add one last thing, which is that I hope that our community really comes together and just realize that we really need to support single mothers and children, because if we don't, we're going to have a much bigger problem. And really, we should be throwing as much money as we can to parents with kids who need help instead of making their lives more miserable and basically shackling them and keeping them in a system that really has no open doors for them.
Well, Mimi, thanks for sharing that. I think this listener, Paul, would agree with you. He writes, I think every legislator should be required to survive on a food stamp budget for a month before voting on any public benefits program. If possible, take away their driver's license, too, to make it more realistic. Thanks, Mimi, and thanks, Paul, for that point. I think what's interesting, and even though we're talking about, you know, homeowners or people who may have employed you as a maid, you also received some of the most heartbreaking stigma from physicians and nurses telling you that you needed to do better, essentially.
Yeah, that was a scene from a pediatrician, and I had brought Mia there several times because she was always struggling with some kind of infection, and she was underweight even, and she just kind of looked at me and said, because I was trying to explain that the apartment we lived in was moldy and it was making us sick, and I worked a lot, and she just looked me in the eye and said, well, you need to do better. And I just kind of tried to tell her, like, well, I can't afford to do better. Like, I try to, but I can't.
One of the things I'm struck by when you write about those experiences is that you don't respond, or that you wish you would have responded now. Do you feel like you've changed, that you're able to stand up and say what you need to say when you're confronted now with those situations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this interview is
is
an example of that. Yeah, I feel much more confident. I don't feel like I need to, like, duck and hide away from anybody telling me what a horrible job I'm doing, or just, like, pointing out, like, well, you could probably do this better. Now I'm just like, you know what? I could, but, like, you know, I'm limited by this or this and this.
How and when did that transformation occur?
Pretty recently, actually. I think, I don't know, maybe, like, seeing the reaction to the book. Because I thought I was going to put out this book that people would react to in a way that they do in the internet comment sections, because I've been a writer on the internet for several years, and I've been tweeted at very harshly. I've had death threats. You know, I've had, like, all of this stuff happen to me, and that always happens when you write about being a single mom on food stamps, and they list all of the things that you did that make it your fault that you're in that position. And so I thought I would get a lot more of that.
Did you get this too? Virginia says, I cleaned houses and kept the code of ethics. I never have nor never will discuss my clients and their homes with anyone under any circumstances. She isn't the first to pull this.
Well, I don't know. I've had a client read the book and she couldn't identify herself in it. So I tried very hard to keep the identities and any identifying characteristics hidden from that.
Well, this listener tweets, kind of tangential, but has Stephanie seen Alfonso Cuarón's film Roma? What did you think? And for those who haven't seen, Roma is about a year in the life of a middle-class family's maid in Mexico City in the early 1970s.
I've been asked that several times.
Really?
And I haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet. I don't have chances to watch TV very often. I still have I have two girls now and keep up a three-bedroom house that I'm renting. And then on top of the work that I do, promoting this book primarily right now. And then I'll get back into writing someday.
And when you're not writing, what other work do you do? I know you've been able to take some time to focus on this because of the reporting project, right?
Did that well, help? Not so much to them. I am usually a writing fellow through the Center for Community Change and write several pieces a month through them. But I'm also a freelance writer. And then I recently got a lot into teaching and just doing kind of whatever I can to keep the income coming in. I guess I'm going to be a public speaker now. So that is also going to keep me away from the house and busy.
Well, this listener writes, it's so sad that the abuses Barbara Ehrenreich exposed almost two decades ago are still alive, well, and thriving in the American workforce. When you look into the future now, do you see substantive and systemic changes happening in the way that we understand poverty and the programs that we have out there to address them?
I mean, I hope so. I hope people can get behind supporting our kids. You know, I hope that there's some kind of universal preschool or universal child care or universal health care for children. I think if we can't get behind removing work requirements for food, then we could possibly get behind taking care of our children.
Well, this listener writes, I'm curious about her plans for the future. Another book?
I mean, yeah, it feels a little masochistic right now to start that huge of a project. But I have several books floating around in my head and one will rise to the surface eventually.
Well, Olga writes, I just finished reading Maid this morning and loved the book. It made me really think about the way I interact with the woman who cleans my home. I was paying my house cleaner $24 an hour, and I immediately raised her pay $2 an hour. It also reminded me how insane our public support system is in this country, how you have to work so hard to prove you're poor to receive the meager benefits that are allotted to folks who most desperately need the help. Ultimately, what impact are you hoping this book has? I mean, we've talked about sort of different things like this specific interactions that people who employ house cleaners may have with them or maids. But is there something else that you're hoping it does?
I hope it evokes empathy. I hope that the distance that we put between ourselves and people who are in poverty is lessened. I think we like to place a lot of blame on people in poverty because since they have not gotten a college education or had a child out of wedlock, then we'll never be in their place. But I hope that people start seeing just the human aspect of this story and that it evokes a lot of compassion.
Stephanie Land's book is Maid, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. She'll appear tonight at 7 at Coppersfield's Books in Petaluma, tomorrow at 4 at Booksmith's The Bindery in San Francisco, and Sunday at 1 at Book Passage in Corte Madera. We thank you for being here with us on Forum today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our listeners for their questions and stories. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.